Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If your activity's been down, the last quarter's a good time to bring it up, because that's when your evaluation's going to be done, and we all know this job is, what have you done for me lately?
It was 2010 when the Village Voice first released excerpt of what's come to be known as the NYPD tapes, secretly recorded by Officer Adrian Schoolcraft at the 81st Precinct in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. The tapes showed how higher-ups encouraged officers to get their numbers up for low-level offenses while keeping the numbers low for more serious crimes. At a time when the future of policing is one of the main issues in the mayoral race, the debate over how to keep crime down is central. Joining me now is Graham Raymond, investigative reporter for The Village Voice. He's author of a new book based on his original investigations, The NYPD Tapes, A Shocking Story of Cops, Cover-Ups, and Courage is the name of the book. Welcome back to WNYC, Graham.
Thank you very much.
So can you remind us, we've talked about this on the show before, but give us the one-minute version of who Adrian Schoolcraft was, that NYPD officer who made these recordings. Who is he and why did he do it?
He was born in Texas. He became a cop in 2002, mainly because his mother wanted him to become an officer. He didn't really want to come to New York, but he did for her sake. And he made secret recordings in the 81st Precinct in Bed-Stuy because there are a number of reasons, but I think the main reason is that he wanted to build evidence of things that he saw that were going on in the precinct that he didn't agree with. And those ranged from refusing to take crime reports to orders to stop and frisk quotas to orders to make illegal arrests to poor training. I mean, his tapes really, you know, if you think of the police department as this incredibly efficient entity, you listen to those tapes and it sounds more like a big bureaucracy that has its own, that has a number of problems, in its daily operations.
So your book tells Schoolcraft's story prior to the 2010 series that you did about the NYPD tapes, and then it follows what happened to Schoolcraft after those investigations came out. But you start the book in the hallway outside the emergency room in Jamaica Hospital in Queens. It's chilling. Can you explain what was happening to Adrian Schoolcraft in that scene?
Sure. He had gone to an investigative unit in the police department 3 weeks earlier and reported downgrading of crimes. He met with the investigators for 2 hours. And in the intervening period, Internal Affairs was leaving messages for him at the precinct. My reporting indicates that his bosses may have found out about that. Now, so on Halloween night, he goes home early from work in a kind of a minor administrative violation. And in response to that, they come to his house and they drag him out, take him to the Jamaica Hospital psych ward for 6 days where he's held against his will. And he's never really given a reason for why he was held for those 6 days or what it was about. It was, in essence, it was kind of a trumped-up excuse. They wanted him to go to the station house to talk about leaving work early. He refused to leave his apartment. So if he was apparently sane enough to go back to the station house, but the top-ranking officer on scene there, Michael Marino, deputy chief, basically lost his temper and ordered Schoolcraft taken to the psych ward.
You note, we'll take listener questions in just a minute, but one thing you note in the book at one point is that Adrian Schoolcraft is not what you call a perfect source. So when you say that the NYPD took him to a psych ward for 6 days, what's the context? I mean, what's the defense of the NYPD when they say how he ended up in a psych ward?
What's the NYPD's defense?
Yeah. And how does this fit with?
Well, the officers on the scene, I was able to obtain the internal reports of their interviews, and they say, well, he was acting crazy. The problem is that the tape recording doesn't support that. A Schoolcraft recorded the entire event. It's about a 90-minute tape, and he comes off as fairly reasonable. There's a standard that the police have to make in order to do what they did, to take someone to a psych ward. I can't just do it willy-nilly. And based on my reading of my listening to the tape and the standard in the law, I don't think they made it, you know. So the other thing is that's very interesting is that after this incident happened, the department went to great lengths to write these reports, which made it seem like he really was out of, you know, which kind of pumped up this idea of him being crazy. But the tape doesn't support it. You know, they kind of ignore the, in other words, they kind of ignore the tape and rely on the interviews of the police officers that were there.
One of the primary arguments in your book is that the NYPD across precincts has a unwritten culture of wanting to raise the number of summons for low-level crimes and decrease the stats on serious crimes. So the first thing I want to do is invite listeners to call in. We've talked so much about stop and frisk in this mayoral campaign. It's a big issue right now. But what about this issue of crime statistics and CompStat, the NYPD's policing philosophy? The phone lines are open now. If you have any stories about what it's been like to interact with police along these lines, does that sound familiar to you, this idea of increasing the numbers of summonses for low-level crimes and then not hearing back from police if you are reporting a more serious crime? Tell us. The phone number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As those calls come in, I want to play another clip from the tapes recorded by Schoolcraft. This one on the other side of the numbers equation than quotas. This is about keeping serious crime numbers down. Let's take a listen to this.
Don't be afraid to question a robbery suspect. If it's a little old lady and they got my bag stolen, she's probably telling the truth. Mm-hmm. All right? If it's some young guy who looks strong and healthy, can maybe defend himself, and he got yoked up, and he's not injured, he's perfectly fine, and he's just whatever, question that.
So there we hear someone saying, question someone who says they're a victim of a crime if they're young and healthy and look like they're not injured. Why would the NYPD want to question a victim, someone who comes to them and says, I was the victim of a crime?
This is one of the byproducts of CompStat. CompStat is a crime-fighting strategy where you target specific areas, use statistics to target problem areas. As over the past 20 years, as the strategy has evolved, it has become a method by which NYPD commanders get promoted. If you show good numbers, you get promoted. Okay, so that filters down into the precincts, and the crime reports become commodities that are in essence traded. That they're like almost they're examined very closely, much more closely than they used to be decades ago, for just what kind of crime it is, with an eye towards trying to reduce the crime so it doesn't get into their major crime statistics. And that's what he's saying there. He's telling the cops to question. I mean, if I walk in off the street and I report a robbery, that should just be taken. Okay, I made a robbery complaint. It's up to the detectives to determine whether it's an actual robbery complaint or I'm lying or whatever. But this is a patrol sergeant. What he's telling them to do that at the very beginning, when the person is just coming up to try to report it. And that's a product of this constant downward pressure on the numbers from CompStat.
Constant downward pressure on serious crimes, upward pressure on low-level crimes. So you have this sort of two messages happening at once.
Well, it's upward pressure on summonses and stop and frisks. One of the main reasons why the stop and frisk numbers went up so much in the last 8 years is because of this constant pressure. And you can hear it in the tapes. You can hear, just go out and get me some stop and frisk. You know, just go out and get me one or two just to show that we're doing our jobs. The same thing with summonses.
What have you made of the way crime and policing strategies have been talked about in the mayoral race? It's stop and frisk has been one of the few dividing lines in the Democratic primary among the Democratic candidates. Bill Thompson and Bill de Blasio on policing strategies say they want to go back to community policing. as sort of an alternative to Compstat. Christine Quinn has said anybody would be lucky, any new mayor would be lucky to have Ray Kelly stay on, so sort of saying the current philosophy should continue on. Republican Joe Loda has said, I was there when Compstat was formed, and basically articulated that this is a good strategy that's kept the city safe. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your reporting has penetrated what the public debate has been about policing? Do you think there's been enough conversation about how the NYPD is functioning right now?
Well, a lot of those words that you used, that the candidates are using, are kind of buzzwords. I don't know if they entirely understand what they mean. I mean, you know, community policing, this is an interesting anecdote that's in the book. The broken windows theory is a famous essay which was written, and it was used as a basis for Compstat, the broken windows theory being that if you don't repair a broken window, other things are going to be broken and more vandalism will take place. And but in that article, which was used as an underlying element of Compstat, the authors actually applaud community policing. You know, so
they're not necessarily opposites or different or wholly different.
Well, yeah, the terms, you know, the terms are kind of interchangeable or used for different purposes. I mean, Compstat is a strategy. I mean, Compstat is a strategy. Stop and frisk is a strategy. Police officers need to interact with the community. I mean, it's important. You need to go up and be able to talk to somebody. It's just that it can't be based on race, and it can't be based on quotas. It's got to be based on a crime that has taken place and a specific description. That's the standard. So I'm not really sure at this point what the candidates are going to do when they get into office based on what they've said so far.
Let's talk about how the NYPD has responded to your reporting over the years. It's been a number of years since your series first came out. The first thing I want to ask you about is a report that was released last month from the Crime Reporting Review Committee, which was commissioned by Police Commissioner Ray Kelly to review Compstat. And it actually confirmed much of what Schoolcraft and these recordings suggested was happening. Are we seeing any change now from NYPD because they've put out this review? Did you think that review was sufficient?
Well, Commissioner Kelly's strategy on the Schoolcraft case has been very interesting. It's been very intelligent. He's fought kind of a rearguard action. In other words, slowing down the decision. So this panel was supposed to be completed in 6 months. It took over 2 years to get done. He's issued some departmental orders very quietly, which address some of these very things: failing to take reports, referring people to other precincts when they shouldn't be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's transferred some of the main characters in the story, or he's filed disciplinary charges against them and held those charges in abeyance for now over 2 years. So this report, I thought it was well done. Actually, I think the panel did a good job on it. I'm not sure exactly what's going to result from it. I think Kelly's remarks on it were a little bit hedged, and I couldn't tell exactly what he's going to do. I mean, I think the main thing is that the message goes out to the precincts. The message is, take the reports. Don't fool around with the reports. Don't give people a hard time about filing a report. I mean, that should be the message, and that should be, you know, driven home very clearly throughout the department.
We're getting some calls, and I want to just take a few back-to-back-to-back. Elizabeth in Brooklyn, what's your story about interacting with the NYPD?
A couple of my friends had a really horrible experience a few years back. They were living in the East Village, and they were out on their terrace, just kind of hanging out, having a beer. And there was this kind of car pile up in the street below them because this one car wouldn't move. A bunch of people were yelling at them to move so no cars could get by. So they yelled over the balcony and were like, hey, you got to move in. You got to move in. And this plainclothes guy on the ground looks up at them and says, shut the expletive up. And, they kind of yell back at him, no, you do it. Da, da, da. And all of a sudden, they find out he was an undercover cop because all these other cops come out of nowhere, go into their apartment building, into their apartment, and arrested my friend and his other friend and took them down to the precinct, you know, over nothing. And then I wanted to, juxtapose this to another story that happened a few weeks ago when I was walking to work, I live out in Bushwick, and I saw this guy really, really awfully manhandling his girlfriend. He had knocked her to the ground and was trying to drag her back somewhere, it looked like, back to his apartment by her hair, and she was screaming. And I called the cops, and I told them exactly where it was, and I waited there and waited and waited. He eventually got her back into the apartment, and the cops never came. And I tried to call the next day, and they told me they couldn't give me any information. And I never knew, you know, what happened with that.
Thanks so much for your call, Elizabeth. So two different scenarios happening there, those two trends you described, Graham. Andrea in the Bronx, what's your story of interacting with the NYPD?
My son was a victim of being stopped on the subway, going through the subway doors while the car wasn't moving. And he's not exactly your typical stop and frisk. He's a skinny white kid. He's very bookish. And he walked through the doors of the subway while it was in the station. And a policeman pulled him off the train. And he was really petrified. They never laid a finger on him, but this was kind of the equivalent of jaywalking. Nobody ever gets stopped for going through subway doors.
Thanks for your call, Andrea. Tom, in the South Bronx, you have a different take on this. What do you want to say about the NYPD?
I have a lot of friends that are cops. I have a brother who was a former cop, and the cop statistics were cut both ways. A precinct commander is responsible to the higher-ups, and with the statistics, he can actually put policemen where he thinks there are issues that are ongoing. You know, they have what they call hot corners, certain areas of their precinct that there's a surge in crime. So he can station more officers there and actually do undercover work there with narcotics officers. So there is a good thing to it in that the statistics help commanders direct officers and manpower. The bad part about the statistics, as the statistics can be manipulated, as we're hearing from the callers, and also those statistics can be used against what they call problem officers that they want to get rid of, or they don't feel that are in the company way, that they're saying, well, you're not doing your job because you didn't do this many arrests, this many stops, and we can see that by your performance over the past couple of months. So we don't think you really meet the grade, so we're going to demote you or not promote you. And also the precinct commanders, if they personally want to get promoted, which is a lot of them want to do after 5 or 10 years, they can show they can artificially drop their numbers down, showing that they're performing well, especially if they know a review is coming up and those statistics are going to be evaluated, so they themselves can get promoted. You know, we're very data-driven at this point. You can see in the teaching profession, but also reflects the police officers.
Thanks for your call, Tom. So, Graham, that's what you were saying, that promotions now have been institutionalized, that it's very much based on whether your numbers are good. And good numbers mean low levels of serious crimes, high numbers of low-level summonses.
That's correct, yeah. In the book, there's some amazing comments where the precinct commander is saying the deputy chief is going to go through the roof if we don't get our numbers up. I mean, that's this caller made a good point, which is that it all rolls downhill. So the same pressure that are on the patrol officers, it's just as bad on the precinct commanders. The precinct commanders are hearing it from the borough command and from police headquarters. Police headquarters has the ability now to track the activity, which summons is in the numbers of, I think, every police officer in the department, which that wasn't the case. So this statistics-driven model has police department monitoring, police headquarters monitoring 30,000 police officers across the city. So yeah, I mean the precinct commander is definitely under a lot of pressure from the higher ups, and that's what leads them to evolve these many different types of tactics to show better numbers.
I want to ask you about where Adrian Schoolcraft is now. I mean, the book chronicles that he has been in this employment limbo with the NYPD. He's filed a lawsuit against the NYPD, and it's scheduled to go on trial in September, right?
Well, the September date was turns out to be quite optimistic. there haven't been any depositions taken, as far as I know, and there's probably about three dozen or four dozen that are going to be that they're seeking to take. The city has fought kind of a slowdown battle. The school crafts have had some issues with their legal representation, currently they're. Adrian and his father, Larry, are still upstate, north of Albany, in a small town. Adrian is still in suspended without pay. The department could have fired him at any point after December of 2009 because he refused to come into work. You have to be, if you're AWOL for 5 days, they can fire you automatically. Obviously, the department must think that firing him would have looked bad, so they haven't. And recently, Judge Robert Sweet, who's the judge in Schoolcraft's lawsuit, ordered the city not to do anything about his personnel status until his lawsuit, his litigation in federal court is complete.
So that is still yet to come. So why write the book now when we're still waiting to see how this is resolved?
Well, this is a good question. The journalist in me wanted to wait, thought that it would be interesting to see what happened. However, with a story like this, it's going to continue to evolve as time goes on. I mean, this could go on for another year and a half or 2 years. And I think the most powerful resonant elements of this story have already taken place. And I think this was a good time before we know the outcome to get the book out there.
And as far as solutions, I mean, is it being a data-driven police department that you feel like it will ultimately lead to manipulation of numbers? Would you like a reevaluation of that? Is it a change in leadership? I mean, we've already seen some changes in top NYPD leadership as Bloomberg's term comes to an end.
I think it's a cautionary tale. I mean, I think what happened in the 81st precinct has happened and is happening in other precincts. And I think the department just has to be very careful about pushing commanders into a corner like that where they suddenly, I mean, because one thing is that there's a real public effect here. If you're trying to report a crime and they blow you off, there's a guy in the book who gets beaten up, he gets jumped and beaten up pretty badly, and he tries to report it and they won't take the report because he can't describe any of the suspects. So there's a guy who's been, physically injured pretty badly, and there'll be no closure for that because of another agenda that's happening. So CompStat is an effective crime strategy. Stop and frisk is an effective way of can be an effective way of police officers have to talk to citizens. It just has to be they just have to be careful about it and not let the numbers become both the means and the end.
Do you see that? Has that shift happened as a result of your reporting? Do you feel like you're seeing impacts of your reporting today, or do you feel like you still want to see a much bigger cultural shift?
I don't have the bird's eye view of the entire department to answer that question. There have been things that have happened. I'm trying to stay fairly in the middle here and not become an advocate. Adrian Schoolcraft, he's not the perfect human being, but his tapes are powerful, and they are a record of how a police precinct operates day to day, and can be, I think, could be useful in looking at ways to make the policing better in the city.
That's Graham Raymond, investigative reporter from The Village Voice. His new book is The NYPD Tapes, A Shocking Story of Cops, Cover-Ups, and Courage. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
After the break, we'll look at another book, this one about Jane Austen fans, the land of the Janeites. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.